1, 2. All right. Welcome back to Labeled Stories, Rumors, and Legends of Tooth & Nail Records. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today we have a special episode. I'll call it the Demon Hunter Special. It's not part of our normal series where we're going through the larger story arc. This is a one-off kind of thing where we're going to talk to Ryan Clark about Demon Hunter and their new albums, plural, War and Peace. It's a double album. It just came out on March 1st. So that's what this episode is going to discuss. Ryan Clark is a very important figure in Tooth & Nail history and always worth a chance to get inside of his head and see what he's up to and how he's thinking about things. I always enjoy that. Now, we will get back to the larger story arc, so don't worry. We're not skipping ahead. We'll still be around the time of 1997, 98, and we're going to be covering the time period between, you know, MXPX and the Supertones, but before Tooth & Nail joins up with EMI and then has a bunch of breakout hits and across multiple genres and things like that, and what the partnership with EMI was like and what was good and what was bad about it and all the artists that we're going to get to. We're going to get to all that stuff, but first we're going to still cover some more of time in the 90s and things like that. So I'm going to try and include as much stuff as I can. And it's basically a time where Brandon identifies it as they didn't have a huge breakout hit, but on the other hand, it's one of the most fun times in the label with the most diversity and the most stuff going on. The label is huge and very healthy and great. So we're going to talk about how the generation kind of changed and punk maybe gave way a little bit to some other genres. And we're going to do that next, but you're going to have to wait a little bit for it. And the reason why is because I'm having my third child any day now. So I'm going to be safe and take a little break. And I'm going to set April 17th as when we get back, and you're gonna have to wait that long, and I am sorry for that, but that's just the safest idea. It'll allow me to get ahead and really look to the future and set stuff up and allow for some personal time. Now, if you're a Labeled member, which means you support us financially via our Patreon, then I'm gonna be in touch there, and I have some really good stuff that I'm gonna release over the break, so please don't cancel your membership or anything. In fact, it's probably a good time to sign up to be a member, and while we're on break, you'll have all this old tape, all the old episodes, a bunch of special tape you've been hearing about will be available to you while you're waiting on April 17th. So anyway, I'm going to release some special and other bonus and other uncut tape and other old archive tape and found footage I have. I'm going to try and find some good stuff like that to put out to the Labeled members. In the meantime, also, of course, join the Labeled Facebook group. That's free and open to anybody that identifies as part of this community in any way. You can just search for Labeled Podcast Group on Facebook, and we will see you over there. And I want to say thank you to you guys for making this podcast so legit. Like, it's like, it's going really good. This new series we've been doing has really taken off, and I've gotten a tremendous amount of feedback from people all over the place, and it seems to really be working. So thank you for sticking with me through the first iteration where I really did not know what I was doing or what this podcast should be, and it's starting to crystallize, and I'm very excited to go into what I'm calling Act 2 of this particular story, as I mentioned before. So thank you guys for sticking with me and spreading the word. It seems like there's a lot of word of mouth going on, so thank you guys for that. I appreciate it. Okay, so let's get into Demon Hunter's world here. Okay, Ryan, let's dig into this stuff today. We're going to talk about Demon Hunter, the album, War and Peace, and all that stuff. But before we do that, I would like to give a little bit of context for Demon Hunter. Also, I got to tell everybody, we're going to actually cover Demon Hunter as part of this larger series and sequence and the origin and rise as it belongs in this series flow. But we're not there yet, but we are to the part where Demon Hunter has a new double album out. So that's all we're going to talk about mostly today. But I do want to catch people up with some context. I asked the people in the Labeled members group stuff that they'd want to know about you and things like that. And they sent a bunch of really cool stuff. But mainly, Can we start by talking about Training for Utopia for a few minutes before We get into these songs and this album?
Yeah, that's great.
Just to give everybody a full context. A lot of questions about that. So, and also the next Labeled episode we're going to do, we're going to kind of cover the period of time from like 97 to 2000.
Okay.
And you were around and active as an artist kind of in that time, right? So yeah, Focal Point and Training for Utopia.
Yeah. So 97, I believe that's when, I think Focal Point signed in 95 or 96. And then I think our album came out in 97. Gosh, I think we toured in 97. I know we toured in 97. Mm-hmm. So that was off the heels of the first record, or the only record. And Training was very soon after. So Focal Point came home, broke up essentially, and then training started doing the EP and all that stuff. And by 1998, the summer of 98, we were already touring with Training for Utopia. And so that basically brought us up to 2000. That band kind of disbanded. My brother and I moved to Seattle in the year 2000 in the summer. And then talks about starting some kind of new band happened within that first year of living in Seattle.
Cool. Now, let's talk specifically about Training for Utopia. What was that band about that is different than Demon Hunter? Let's go through some of the differences in your mind of what Training for Utopia was and what Demon Hunter is.
Sure.
Because they both are very much you.
Sure, yeah. Training for Utopia almost symbolizes a time in my musical growth of something that was a little bit more niche and a scene that was sort of popping off in the underground at the time, that, you know, a lot of people categorize as noisecore. This is all the kind of hardcore sub-genre that would encompass bands like Coalesce, Converge. You know, at the time, there weren't a ton of bands, but there were some really smaller kind of niche bands on labels from, like, King of the Monsters was a small kind of, like, noisy label. There was a band called Swing Kids, a band called Spanacorzo. Like, some early stuff was, like, Dead Guy. Prior to Dead Guy was Rorschach. It was a very much like a niche thing, like I said. So for us, it was kind of, there was a cool factor to it because it wasn't quite in vogue at the time. It hadn't really popped off in, you know, coming after the off the heels of bands like Botch and things like that. You know, you saw Norma Jean kind of like start to really make an impact and people start to really take notice. But before, it was, when we were doing that kind of thing, it was not popular at all. It was not the kind of thing that would draw a ton of people at shows. We were considered kind of the outsiders of the hardcore scene, and I think a lot of those bands were. Even Converge, you know, they've kind of become a household name in the hardcore and metal scenes now, but that's only by virtue of how long they've been playing and the fact that that sort of sound kind of came around to being something more palatable for people. So at the time, we were into all kinds of stuff. We were into the more groovy metal stuff that's kind of like what Demon Hunter plays these days. You know, we were into Sepultura and Fear Factory and Deftones and At the Gates and, you know, the Swedish death metal stuff. And we were into all of that. But the thing that at that time that appealed to us most was the Neurosis stuff, the Today is the Day stuff, the Bloodlet stuff, like all of the more niche, more the stuff that felt like more of a secret part of the scene. And so I think there was a time and place for us to kind of explore that world. But I do, for us at least, think that it was a bit more of a fleeting, I don't want to say a fleeting trend, but like our interest in that specific subgenre started to wane a little bit. And you can hear, if you listen to the second full length, Throwing a Wrench into the American Music Machine, that's a pretty obvious reflection of our interest in that scene's, you know, kind of changing. And we were kind of, at that point, trying to mix things up and do something really weird and odd and mixing genres and things like that. So, towards the end of that, we didn't really know where we were headed or what we were trying to do. And then when it came time to think of doing some other type of band, after we had moved to Seattle, it was more about like going back to some of those first loves of ours in terms of the music that really resonated with us over the years. And for us, that was the more groove stuff, groove-oriented stuff like Machine Head and Fear Factory and Pantera and stuff like that. So that's really where we gravitated towards as something that we thought would be more interesting and have a longer shelf life for us as individuals.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly experimental is a word to describe it. You know, I think especially when it's underground stuff, it's kind of experimental in nature anyway. And then you took Train for Utopia and even more so that when you start mixing genres and industrial and all that kind of stuff. So then when Demon Hunter starts, it is less, it's more cohesive, and it knew what it seems, at least, that Demon Hunter knew exactly what it was as you've been doing graphic design and paying attention to the scene. And now Demon Hunter exists, and it seems so cohesive and solid from, and I want to introduce just the word brand here. Mm-hmm. How do you think of Demon Hunter's brand as a whole? Because it's been, it's changed, of course, over time in the different records, but it is still, Demon Hunter is very, very clear what is in its boundaries and what is not, and its imagery and the lyrical tone all the way through. And if we jump in here on War and Peace, which we're going to in a second, it's still very consistent with what Demon Hunter always has been. And I think I have a decent grip on it. I remember when Demon Hunter started.
Yeah.
I've worked on a Demon Hunter record, and I've known you throughout this whole period of time. So I think I feel on pretty good footing when I say Demon Hunter's always been relatively brand cohesive and not so much experimental. So
no.
How intentional is that, and how do you think about that?
Well, the early days, we were definitely trying to figure out what it was we were going to do. You know, that's why some of the very first imagery that you see from Demon Hunter was really kind of secretive, and we didn't really have an actualized group of guys playing the music yet. At, you know, for the first album, it was basically my brother and I wrote a bunch of songs. Aaron Sprinkle, the producer, suggested his brother Jesse play drums on the record. He ended up being a member for the first two records. And then when it came time to actually play the stuff live, that's when we decided we needed to come up with a band of guys that can actually play this stuff. And so we basically comprised a band out of people that we worked with at the label. Mm-hmm. So it was still a bit of a mystery to us, like what that blueprint was going to be early on, but it starts to solidify pretty quickly. Things like the logo, that mm-hmm. became pretty clear to us that it had legs, and it was something that people dug and they were interested in and resonated with people shortly after that first album. And even prior to that, the funny story behind the Demon Hunter logo is that we designed it and slapped it on a shirt, and Brandon Ebel suggested we just throw it in the Solid State, you know, web store prior to even releasing any music. So we put a shirt up there before we had even written a song, and we had sold like 20 shirts.
I intend to cover even the origin story of Demon Hunter in great detail in the future. So
yeah.
Don't give all that away, okay. But yeah, I hear you.
But the logo, it was obvious from the onset that the logo was something that had some staying power. And so when we did the first album cover, we knew at that point, let's do the thing that, you know, the band Chicago and bands like that kind of do, where they take the same sort of logo or motif and they just change it per record. So even decisions like that, we knew that we wanted to do based on that first record. But the branding of Demon Hunter being important just comes by virtue of us having been designers at the time. For me, it was a fairly new career, but my brother had been doing it for, you know, probably 5-6 years at that point. And so it was not only a very important aspect to the band in the way that we wanted to deliver it, whether it was through the photos or through the branding and the logos or the packaging. But it was also that world of design and taking the special attention and care was accessible to us because that's what we did all the time. So it was the sort of thing that we could, we had like right at our fingertips. And we were slowly learning how to navigate the worlds of branding and things like that for other bands. And so it was still fairly experimental early on, but it became a really important part of the whole. more so as years went on.
But you knew that it was that Demon Hunter, if it were to exist in 5 years and 10 years, would be within its bounds of exactly what Demon Hunter was versus this evolving expression of yourself.
Yeah,
I'm trying to wrestle with those two categories a little bit.
Yeah, there's a great quote. I don't know it verbatim, but by Jamie Josta that says, you know, when I go to McDonald's, I don't want Taco Bell, you know. So there's there's a certain, I always think about something at least adjacent to that mentality when writing Demon Hunter stuff, is that I don't want to necessarily do the Radiohead thing where five records in we're like an entirely different band. I aim to deliver, on one hand, something that's moderately familiar to fans because up to this point they have supported that thing. And then on another hand, probably smaller, I want to have the freedom to explore and change and adapt and evolve. For us, for the most part, it's meant more technicality over the years. That's by virtue of better musicians being in the band, to be honest. But it's also something that I always aspired to do with Demon Hunter, is go more toe-to-toe with a lot of that Swedish death metal stuff that we loved so much. And in the early years, we couldn't play any of that stuff, so we naturally sounded more like a hardcore band doing a metal thing. These days, yeah. I feel like we sound more like a metal band doing a metal thing, and yes. kind of living within that same general environment that some of those Swedish death metal bands, In Flames, Soilwork, Dark Tranquility, those kind of bands, where they're coming from. Granted, I still don't think we're quite as technical as those bands, because again, I like for there to be a balance of what we were and what you know, where we're going.
So certainly in the broad sense, going from hardcore to metal is different, but it still, of course, is in the general sense well within the bounds of things where your themes are still there, darkness and you know, death, the themes that always come up. That's something that people were asking a lot about in the Facebook group. Another one was, somebody said, and I think this actually relates, even though it may be somewhat meant as a joke, do you ever laugh or smile?
Oh, yeah, pretty much.
Now, that's funny, of course, because I've been around you clowning infinitely, laughing, smiling, stuff like that. But nonetheless, with the brand, with the image, with what you do, there's actually people out there that may think, well, Ryan is just this very serious guy who only thinks about darkness and death.
Sure.
So how do you, I mean, is it just part of your personality? Is it you pretend to be a dark guy obsessed with death, or what is it?
It is. Demon Hunter is my outlet to talk about things of a very serious nature. And part of my want to do that is that it's not a normal part of my daily life. Like you said, goofing off and having fun is like what we do. And it's part of being in this band. It's part of my relationship I have with the guys. Like, it's just constant fun, constant jokes. But when I sit down to do something that I hope will resonate with people, that I hope will be something that they can take with them for years and make part of their identity as a person, to me, that's a more serious natured thing. And so that's become kind of the tone of voice for the band, at least outwardly. The things that we're public about, for the most part, we're not a jokey band, we're not a goofy band, we don't take funny photos, we don't do funny videos. And that's intentional, because even though that might work for some bands, I feel like what works best for us is for the way that I speak to fans and the way that I write lyrics and the way that we represent ourselves in a public fashion to mirror more closely what is being talked about in the songs. What's, you know, the sort of like really deep and serious natured things that I deal with in lyrics.
Absolutely. So that, again, forgive me for using the term brand, but you actually tie it together there better. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd summarize that as you are concerned primarily with the fans' total experience with you and your music, and you want that to be cohesive.
Yes. Right? Yeah. And I know for some bands, the lack of cohesion can kind of be their calling card. Like if you look at a band like Mastodon, you know, their lyrics aren't funny. Their lyrics are somewhat serious, at least from what I understand. But then they'll do the goofy videos, and they'll be fun and funny in photos and on stage and in banter and things like that and in interviews. that's become their tone of voice, that part of their brand, and that works for them. It doesn't necessarily undermine the things that they say in their songs, but that's just a choice that they've made in, you know, over the years of doing this. For us, we made a choice to be a little bit more serious when we're addressing the public.
Well, I'll move into talking about War and Peace here with one more question from somebody that is akin to a bit of a conspiracy theory, Ryan. And it says, were you trying to cash in on the Pokemon Go hype by launching two albums at once, since Pokemon Go games come in pairs? Your name's Demon Hunter, which already sounds a lot like Monster Hunter. Plus, you have a song called Ash, who's the main character in the TV Pokemon series. So have you been exposed as a Pokemon ripoff artist?
That would be strictly a coincidence. I am a 40-year-old man, and my daughter is still too young, I think, to really be into Pokemon. I would love to perpetuate that, but it's not, but it's not true.
Well, let's go ahead into those two albums and, you know, the thinking behind a double album. Let's just start there. Why a double album?
Yeah, well, it's something that we've kicked around for years, to be honest. We had talked to the label about doing, you know, a double album or two albums simultaneously, probably in like 2011, 2012. At that point, it was something that it seemed like not everyone was on board with. And I'm kind of glad that it didn't pan out at that point, because I feel like this is the best time in our career to be doing something like this. I think there's a time where it might feel a little too early to do something like this. For us, rounding out albums 9 and 10, it felt really good to do both at the same time. Also, just by virtue of having Patrick, who is a key songwriter at this point, helping me with those duties, something like this is much more easy to actualize at this point in our careers. After my brother had left in 2008, I took the reins of songwriting entirely for the next three records. And it wasn't until Outlive, our one last record, that Patrick became like a pretty major player in the songwriting process. So coming off the heels of Outlive and just seeing the sheer volume of stuff that Patrick was able to send me, I think it was something like 30 demos for that record and another 30 for this one. And he's already working on stuff for the next one. So it's like he's just a writing machine. Meanwhile, I've written a ton of stuff for this band. And so getting some fresh blood and some, you know, especially from a person who's 10 times the player that I am, was not only nice in terms of kind of reinvigorating the band and helping us feel and sound fresh, but it was also just the only way that we were going to be able to bite off something this robust, because I'm able to kind of take a chunk of songs, write the music for my songs, write the lyrics and melodies for however many that might be, and then with Patrick's songs, I have these really well constructed, you know, amazing songs, and I only have to focus on lyrics and melodies. So it makes it a little more fun to tackle 22 songs than like being a burden. So
that's crazy, because I already have you personally in the category of squarely in the category of prolific. I mean, I remember your demos from Storm the Gates of Hell, which is one I engineered, coming in while you were full-time graphic design and doing all the stuff, playing Demon Hunter shows. You just had all these demos all the way detailed out that you had made yourself for that. I think that's when Patrick came in on that record, or right before, around that time. And I was already impressed with the amount of work you're able to do by yourself in that detail, which must have been in your evenings and off time. So
yes,
I'm not surprised if you can add a Patrick on top of that and then work together. I mean, you know, and again, just to get to 10 albums is, I mean, how many other bands have done that in this time span and survived and lasted? So it's you've definitely got everything firing on all cylinders. And I'll take this time too to say that Jeremiah did an incredible job with these records. I love it.
Yeah, he did. That's another huge factor, honestly, in us being able to do this, is that we don't need to book studio time anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry about scheduling that kind of stuff. We can do it at our leisure. We can do it when it makes sense. And so Jeremiah and Patrick are in Nashville recording guitars and doing that sort of thing. And then we'll take a month off because it just doesn't make sense for us to do something for a while. And then Jeremiah will fly up here. We'll do the vocals up here together. I'll do some vocals on my own here from my house. And so having the flexibility of like modern technology and all of us kind of having the ability to do this stuff remotely and on our own, and then having Jeremiah, who's a seasoned producer, be able to kind of make sense of it all and put it all together is another huge factor in us being able to do this.
Well, I think it's just terrific. And your album productions over time, starting with Sprinkle and having that, and it's actually kind of in the DNA almost.
Yes.
And then even with Jeremiah, it's again, it's the whole thing's very cohesive. You know, more in a metal direction with using the tools that you have around you. And it's Jeremiah and it's Patrick and it's still Demon Hunter, and really, really good job all the way around on that. Let's talk about some specific songs.
Sure.
And we'll just kind of go in order from War to Peace. We'll do a couple of each, but let's talk about the song The Negative. So
yeah.
I want to talk about the lyrics and stuff like that, but I'd start with a couple of notes I made about just, I want to guess at a little bit of this and ask a couple of questions. Arrangement-wise, the form is really cool. That weird thing that happens in the second half of the verses
mm-hmm.
is kind of a unique kind of change in the middle of something that could have just been a verse.
Sure.
I'm curious where that came from.
That's a song that I wrote, and it's more my style to go a little bit off of the grid in terms of the structure. The inspiration for the first thing that you hear right when it kicks in is Nine Inch Nails. What is it? March of the Pigs or whatever.
I know the outcome. I will separate the very metal from the waste that I hate.
Theirs is a little bit more of an electronic kind of sound, and it's a little bit off time, which makes it really cool. And the thing I was working on kind of started that way and kind of evolved into this just like snare. What do you call that snare beat, that Johnny Cash?
Yeah.
I don't know what you call that, but it evolved into that sort of thing as the key backbone, which Motley Crue did in a very popular song. So that was kind of, you know, there was some inspiration there too. Kickstart My Heart, I believe. But what felt right next was to build it into a more robust sounding all band type of beat and part before going into the pre-chorus, which is almost a verse of its own. Mm-hmm. So again, it's just kind of, I just wanted to mix it up and make it not so rigidly structured as a lot of the other songs are. I think those other songs benefit from their rigidity, but I wanted there to be a handful of songs on the album that didn't necessarily have to follow that same mm-hmm. template.
I thought it was a real nice choice because it feels like out of left field, and then that yet again breaks it up. And it, you know, I thought it was I really like that choice a lot. Now, lyrically, this one seems, as many, many do, to be about negativity in a way, or mistrust, or depravity of humans, or something. I'm just throwing stuff out there from the basic amount that I can get from. And you repeat the word hate a bunch of times. The song's called The Negative. No faith in you. You know, all these kinds of things. Will you let us in on what you're thinking lyrically here?
Yeah. This is kind of like a, you know, words that some words that I live by. I've said it a handful of times in interviews and things like that when I'm talking about my general outlook on humanity and the world and friendships and relationships and the way to engage with people in general. And I started thinking that would actually make a pretty good, you know, hook for a song is the fact that for me, instead of everyone that I meet or everyone that I associate with or am friends with or family members or whatever, instead of all those people starting at a place of neutral. I have just this, you know, innate thing in me where people just kind of start at a deficit. Where everyone starts in the negative. I have a bleak outlook on humanity. It doesn't, I think it honestly promotes more happiness, to be honest. I think that people put too much faith in other people. So when those people let them down, they're really bummed out. They're really discouraged. I think that's how people lose friendships. I think that's how, why people kind of bounce from friend group to friend group and don't talk to family members for a long time, et cetera, is because there was something that happened along the way where they were disappointed. They had some sort of expectations for these people or this person, and those expectations weren't met. I have a way of looking at things that is, I'd like to think a little bit more forgiveness than that, whereas if someone starts at a deficit, then they only, you know, meeting my expectations is a nice bonus. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if they don't meet my expectations, if I make plans with someone and they cancel on me last minute, my immediate thought is, that's what happens. You know, I get it, or whatever. Whereas some people might be like, I'm not going to talk to that person for, I had a lot invested in that. I'm not going to talk to that person for a week or 2 weeks or whatever. They're going to have to get back in my good graces.
Yeah, it's tough to perpetually feel like people will let you down. Well, maybe adjust your expectations and may you be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, exactly. I think that has honestly helped me, you know, maintain long-lasting friendships from people that are less trustworthy or whatever. I don't think that it makes them worse friends. I think it just makes them normal people. And so this song's basically an exploration of that. It's like when I say no faith in you, no faith in me, no faith in them, no faith in us. That's me saying like I don't have faith in humanity in general, so that's going to work to people's benefit ultimately. And in the second verse, when I talk about hate, I'm saying that I'm able to, at least I think I'm able to compartmentalize the hate I have for situations versus that of people. And if something really bothers me and something really affects me, I like to be able to compartmentalize that into something that's not like aimed at the person and is more aimed at actions or things like that.
Never a soul to trust, all but one led by a heart of lust.
Yeah. That's basically the caveat, is that, you know, I believe everyone is essentially led by their own selfish motives with the exception of Christ. So that would be the all but one.
Okay. Very good. Very clear. So I was guessing. I was kind of right. I'm not a lyrical specialist, but I always like to have opportunity if I get to ask a lyricist directly what, you know. But I'm of the school of thought that says that the song, it really does, you know, once you write it, it can mean different things to different people. Do you see it that way? Or are you fine with people taking this however it speaks to them? Or do you feel like you have the definitive, this is what this song is?
I like both aspects of that, to be honest. I try to write somewhere between really concise and poetic. And I don't want people to get too lost in the poetry aspect and the vagueness. And so I try not to lean too hard on that side. And that's a perfect example of where Training for Utopia differs from Demon Hunters. Most of the TFU lyrics were very vague and odd and poetic. Whereas with Demon Hunter, you know, again, mimicking the sort of brand that we were and the sort of band that we were trying to be, the clarity of structure and the clarity of who we were, that comes through in the lyrics as well, which is something that, you know, the first thing that's on top of mind when I'm writing lyrics is, will this resonate with someone else? Will someone be able to go, ah, that's me, or that's something I'm dealing with, or that's really helpful, or I'm going to remember that. That sort of thing is super important to me when I'm writing lyrics. Another factor that's important to me, but less important, is to write thought-provoking things, things that will, you know, perhaps be something that someone can take and apply to themselves that maybe I wasn't necessarily aiming at. If it's beneficial to that person, that's awesome. You know, sometimes it goes back the other way where someone thinks I was saying something that I'm not saying, and to them it's a negative mm-hmm. thing. And so that's probably a rarer case, because I believe I am pretty clear in most of it. But I do like the idea that there would be both a clarity to it and then some sort of a thing that you could take and apply to your own life. And so I try and strike a balance.
Yes, well, I think you do that well. The next song I'm going to talk about is No Place For You Here. And this daggum song sounds like a evil bumblebee attack. I mean, I love the way it sounds. It's so atonal and just frightening. Like, it, you know what I mean? I'd mm-hmm. say bumblebee as a intimidating creature, yeah. not a little bee. It's like, holy shit, this thing. Yeah. It feels like I'm being attacked by the song. I love it.
That's great. This one was Patrick wrote the music for it. It was one of the later demos that he sent me. I think it was like number 23 that he had sent me. And I loved it right off the bat. The chorus.
What'd you love about it in the demo? What'd you hear?
Well, like you said, the atonal thing, that anytime that there's that sort of like mid-riff bend that's a Jerry Cantrell thing. That's one of the reasons I'm so like, hooked on Alice in Chains riffs and things like that, is because he does that a lot. Bands that tend to do that, I don't know what it is, but it's just something that I like, that use of the guitar. And so that was something that stood out to me. But also there is a super, unlike most of Patrick's writing, the chorus for this was super, super simple. And so it allowed me to basically write basically whatever I wanted over it. Mm-hmm. If you basically strip everything back and listen to the chorus, it's ba 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 ba. I mean, the rest, you know, most of his songs have some sort of lead happening and it's moving through four or five chords. This one had a simplicity to it that I knew was going to give me a lot of flexibility to write to. So
that's interesting on a couple levels. One is sometimes when you give somebody something that's two chords, they feel like, oh crap, now I have to do all this work to make it good. But you saw it as more an opportunity, like, oh, I'll be able to establish some stuff here, because it's a lot of times people think, uh oh, two chords that are half step apart,
right,
which they are in this case.
Yeah,
this, what am I now? I have to come up with everything. But you're right, you were able to take that stability, which is in contrast to the verse, and then build melody.
Well, I think that's more my wheelhouse. If you listen to the older Demon Hunter stuff, the choruses were very simple chord structures. And the trick there is to come up with something vocally that moves a little bit more than the music itself, and make that dynamic element be the vocal. As opposed to the music, whereas if there's a really complex chord structure or a lead in there with the chorus or something, sometimes the best thing to do is to go more reserved and have it be like a simpler melody with the vocal. But this one, I knew that I wanted to walk around and move around a little bit with the vocal, and so it was a perfect opportunity to do that.
So how about the lyrics on this one? It seems to be about trust and other things like that.
Yeah, so this song is basically about that zone that Christian music can find people in, which is opposition on either side. You're not Christian enough for most Christians, and you're too Christian for non-Christians. And so the concept of there not being a place for you here is like saying, you know, in heavy metal, There's a lot of people who are very precious about whatever the tenets of heavy metal are or should be or whatever, that would say that there's no place for a Christian message or people with that sort of worldview to be, you know, dabbling in heavy metal. And then there's also on the flip side of that, there's the Christians more fundamental side of people saying, you know, there's no place in Christianity for heavy metal. So it's almost like feeling opposition from both sides and feeling very isolated in that way. The verses deal more with me talking, in essence, to other bands who have been given a platform or an opportunity to do good and to benefit other people who I believe are not doing much in that regard. So the I can't trust in you to pull the weight entrusted to every dying light guiding all our blind or whatever it is. Every guiding light guiding our blind. That's me saying, like, if you have some guiding principles as a vocalist of a band, like if you have something to say and you're not using it for good, then I can't trust you to do that. So I'm going to be the one who takes it upon myself to do that. It's a lot of times in songs, I will take the verses and be talking kind of specifically to or about someone. And then in the chorus, I'll almost like put it into a bigger context. So that's almost what this song is.
And can you give us an idea of who you're talking about or what type of artist or people that you can't trust?
Well, this will segue nicely into the other song we might talk about, which is I Don't Believe You. But it's honestly just a general sentiment that I have. I don't often feel like heavy metal lyrics really resonate with me. I don't really get much out of them, whether that's by virtue of them being too poetic or too, a lot of bands try to be really deep and really dark. And to me, it just kind of falls flat because there's no personal engagement. There's nothing to apply to my own life in a lot of cases. And I know that's not always going to be on the agenda for bands, is to be like, you know, to resonate with fans on that sort of level. But I think there's a depth that is possible with a band fan interaction. And I think it can go way beyond the idea of, I love your music a lot. It's heavy and it gets my aggression out and it really helped me. I'm not going to discredit that is a thing, but I think there's a depth beyond that that most bands aren't really concerned with.
So it's like interesting because if something like metal, we know in this aggressive music, we know it fulfills some maybe good or an easy need, like, helps me express my rage or some of those feelings, regardless if I really get the words or not.
Right.
And so it's almost too easy just to make music that will feel that way without actually putting in the work to try to actually have meaning in the words, something
yes.
like that.
Yeah, in essence, yeah.
Yes, I agree that the I'm angry at my stepdad is one of the easiest emotions to conjure musically.
Right. Totally.
But what else are we doing here? Yeah, I think that's a good sentiment.
I think metal it can be just blind aggression, and people might use that effectively as an outlet. But I think there are many steps deeper than that you can go to really truly resonate with people and affect some sort of change in their lives. And I don't think a lot of bands really want to go there or feel like it's their place to go there or whatever. And so I'm saying, essentially, if I can't trust in you to do that, I'm going to do it myself.
I hear that. I like that answer a lot, too. All right, so I Don't Believe You is along the same lines. This is on Peace. So I want to talk about, is this song a ballad? Is Peace really a more mellow album? You know, I think that's the way it comes across. You go War and Peace, and then you lead with War. You know, I was relatively surprised that Peace was so aggressive as it is, but it does have a little bit more range on it. So is this a ballad? What's that one about? How do you think about all those things?
Well, it's part of, I think, the concept of doing the two albums was partially to make both of them feel like a Demon Hunter listening experience. And so instead of doing something that was all the way to one side heavy and then something that's all the way to the other side melodic, which would have been like just acoustic songs and piano ballads, we wanted both of them autonomously to have the same sort of peaks and valleys as a normal Demon Hunter record. The biggest differences are almost in the type of tone. War goes more aggressive tonally, which calls for more screaming. The riffs are generally heavier and faster. And then Peace is somewhere just shy of that, and then all the way down to piano ballad. But I didn't want it necessarily just to be like an acoustic thing. I wanted it to feel like if we were to put out an album that didn't have any screaming on it or hardly any at all, and was kind of championing the more melodic side of the band, what would it sound like? So it's almost just an experiment in that. With a song like I Don't Believe You, this is kind of a perfect example of a song that's kind of right in between worlds. It's still distorted, it's still heavy, although the tempo's a little slower. It's obviously all melodic singing, and it almost has, someone was writing about it and said something about it kind of having a classic rock feel, which is interesting because that's always how we sort of personified elements of the song, at least right when it kicks in. It almost has like a Danzig, you know, simplicity to it when it kicks in. Yeah, so the I Don't Believe You was a song that I wrote and I had in my pocket actually for a long time, probably even prior to Outlive. I had kind of dabbled with the chorus of this one, and it wasn't until this record that I was able to really flesh it out. But I knew that I wanted something that wasn't, that never really, in the choruses, never really quite hit a stride of like, you know, hi-hat beat or whatever it is. It does at the end of the song, but it almost has that tom beat in the choruses, as it's, I don't know, it's almost like a flipped version of like a more typical song where the verses kind of have a straightforward beat and then the pre-choruses and the choruses kind of have this like tom beat thing. I just felt like there was something about the mechanical repetition of it that felt really nice in that regard. Lyrically, it's, like I said, it's coming off of the heels of not being able to trust other bands to kind of carry the weight of whatever that human interaction thing is. It's just about being able to believe what someone's saying. And that I'm not saying that from like a believe in what they're talking about, but believe that, you know, it's... that it's something that they truly believe in, you know, just by believe that in their tone, you know. I think Bono at one point said, like, if you don't believe, what did he say? I'm gonna butcher it. He basically said, like, if you don't believe in what you're saying, you're not going to be able to sing it well. Like in that. In just
I totally
a,
get the sentiment of that.
Just a performance way, like if live you're not feeling it or believing it, you're not going to be able to perform it to its greatest potential. I mean, there's a little bit of sarcasm in this too. That's something that I ought to do sometimes, especially when talking about things like this. In the pre-chorus, it essentially says, it sounds like a fury, I'm sure it is. Something to cure me. The problem is I don't believe you.
Yeah.
So it's like, it sounds like a fury. Like it's heavy. It's aggressive. It's got a lot of energy. Like I'm sure it is, but I just don't believe it.
Sarcastic little line. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, I like that. That's quite interesting. The words atone and gospel are in here, and you already mentioned in the other song about Christ. So, I mean, you're not shying away from some religious and Christian overtones in the lyrics and stuff here, although I don't think that's what this song's about.
No. I mean, that stuff kind of comes pretty freely for me, just in terms of, like, my background. And I like that sort of symbolism, and I like the sort of reverence that comes with a lot of that sort of language, the serious tone that it conjures. And so, you know, sometimes it's just the right word, and sometimes it just fits, you know, or it rhymes or whatever, and it means what I'm trying to say. But I think that the words that I'm usually pulling from, like my vernacular, I think those words just kind of come pretty naturally to me.
Yep, I hear that. Okay, let's do one more song here. Let's talk about Recuse Myself. That's also, and people ask about this, it's lyrics that are centered around and having to do with death. Death is probably your most central theme of your lyrics, would you say?
Of course, yes. It's not until really the second verse that it draws a parallel between what I'm talking about in the first verse and in the choruses, generally speaking. I didn't want death to necessarily be the overt angle of this song. In essence, this song is kind of like an anti-political song. It's a political song about me saying I don't want to be political, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically taking all of the insanity that's been happening over the course of the last few years, and all of the news and the just constant barrage of stuff that we're all supposed to pay attention to and be infuriated with, like all of that stuff. I'd be lying if I said I cared about it. Again, everyone starts in the negative with me. Make that 10 times for politicians and politics and all that sort of stuff, right? So when I'm simultaneously not surprised by any of the stuff that's happening, and also, like, every once in a while I just can't believe what I'm hearing, and then equally I don't care because it's all just part of this thing that I believe is just a flawed institution. I think we as people are flawed. I think that people's faith in other people is a huge flaw. And so it's me basically bowing out of the conversation. I've never wanted Demon Hunter to be a political band. I barely tap it every once in a while if it feels like it's pertinent or it feels like it's going to work with something larger that I'm going to say, but I don't like to really live in that world. I think it's fleeting. I think that it's more often going to put a shelf life on that song or that album or that time period of the band. And so I like to stay away from it for the most part. So this is me essentially saying I like to stay away from it for the most part. You know, like I don't see myself fitting into whatever sort of rigid category is available to people from a political standpoint. I don't associate necessarily with either side. I see myself kind of in between on a lot of issues, sociopolitical issues and things like that. It's not that I don't care about people or about those things. I just think the political system and the systems around that system are so flawed that I don't really care to subscribe to whatever ideals they are telling me are important to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. And I resonate with that too.
I think most people do.
I think they do too. And it's kind of a, I don't know. I mean, I think the same is about, you know, looking at not giving people the benefit of the doubt is a big thing for me. And politically, I totally love to stay out of it as much as possible. You know, and I did say this song, I was keying in on the word about death there, but you're right. That's not what this song is about. But verse two says, I've felt the weight of death and I've held the hand. So,
yeah. So it's basically saying, like, it's almost a two-part thing where let me bow out of the conversation, you know, of politics specifically or things that have to deal with that, because I don't see myself falling into any one particular category that is sensible to a lot of people. Second verse is essentially taking that on a bigger scale and saying, I also don't feel like I fit in, generally speaking, in this world and with people in general. And so mm-hmm. I'm also kind of bowing out of what it means to be like a modern citizen or person in this civilization or whatever. So I'm kind of bowing out of everything that's to be expected of a person in this day and age.
I felt the weight of death. I've held the hand. I've tread a fading light. I'm not afraid to go.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know our whole culture and of punk and all these things, and as we talked about before, and the rest of Labeled is, you know, we feel like it's a little bit of an outsider culture kind of thing, alternative and all those things. I'm just curious, even at this point, you're a super successful musician, lead singer, writer, graphic designer, Grammy Award winning or nominated, and do you still identify with the culture at large as an outsider, however?
I do. I mean, I think that, yeah, I feel the same as I ever did about those sorts of things. Like, I feel like, despite a certain amount of success or whether or not people, you know, agree with me on certain things, I still feel that in regards to the culture at large and the world at large, I still think that I'm very much part of a subculture and part of a counterculture. And so I still think that there's an element of punk rock to this whole thing and my worldview and the way that I think, despite any amount of, you know, success or whatever that might have come with it.
Well, 10 Demon Hunter albums, I just can't believe it. I mean, I remember when it started, and here we are, and we're going to do 10 more or what? I mean, the Blessed Resistance is a big deal. Congratulations on that. And I want to take the time now to say, of course, the album's out, War and Peace. Everybody's streaming it already, I assume. We played some of it here. And you're moving forward to this whole new chapter with the Blessed Resistance, which is, you know, your original fan club, now made this really in-depth thing that people can join as your community. Is that going to fund you guys and keep you going for another 10 records or what?
I mean, it's a huge endeavor for us, and it's, you know, it's a bit of an experiment, but it's one that we're taking like really seriously. You know, we've never quite functioned like a normal band. We've always tried to produce music and albums as often as possible, and a lot of times that's even more frequently than other bands. But the one thing that's always been a little bit harder for us, or something that we just didn't really want to have to do the same as other bands, was to play live a ton. And so the fan club for us has been a way of being a constant thing and being active and you know, communicating with our fans and giving them things and allowing there to be a sort of back and forth without us necessarily having to go out on the road. And so it's kind of an experiment in being a super active band mm-hmm. that's not necessarily super active on the road. So we've put a ton into it so far. I keep like a log of the stuff that we've posted and that we've done. And I think since we launched it in late November, I think there's been maybe like 4 or 5 days where hadn't posted anything. So it's almost every day there's a piece of content, and it's not like we're trying our hardest not to make this like glorified tweets and things like that. Like, we're putting, obviously they get things early, like songs and music videos and sneak peeks and stills and behind the scenes and stuff like that. But tutorial videos, Patrick does guitar playthroughs. We're doing full-fledged podcasts pretty frequently. We're moving into a twice a month podcast. And so the content that we're serving up is very legitimate in terms of being worthwhile for something like this. So, like I said, it's a bit of an experiment for us just to see, like, what does it look like if we devote a ton of time to that sort of interaction? I feel like it's definitely something new for people. So in that regard, there's some people that don't fully get it or are able to wrap their heads around it. And for other people, they're super stoked on it and they totally get it and they think it's very worthwhile. And so we're going to keep plugging away. And the plans that we have for the fan club in the future, I think, are going to be really exciting for people. I think it's going to be kind of the way to be our fan is going to be interacting with us through this channel. So we're really, really excited for what the future holds.
I think you're right on point with it, or at least that's my opinion too, is building real communities of meaning and value for small amounts of individuals, smaller instead of broader, does actually create more total value for more people and meaning in the world. And I'm all about the exploration of those things. And I would encourage people to, you know, join some communities, support some communities. You don't have to hang out in the main public square where everybody yells at each other. Well, find the people that are like you, go join the Blessed Resistance. You know what I mean? Join a community, put in some time there with people like you that like stuff. And Demon Hunter just has some pretty diehard and serious and recognizable, and you know, your fans are some very serious people about what they are, and you know, I've been around them a lot, and good luck with that. And that's what, blessedresistance.com?
Yep,
that's all right. Right, and that's where you will be. So if you want to hang out with Ryan and get to know him more, that's where he'll be. And
that's
then
true.
Like I said, we'll cover some Demon Hunter origin and importance of you and some other stuff as it pertains to the whole label story in, you know, a period of weeks for now. It's on the slate, so I'll probably need to talk to you again at some point, but wanted to pop in today and talk about War and Peace. Great effort all around, and everybody go download it. Everybody go listen to it, stream it, and let's get the word of mouth up for the art and the people and the creators we support. Just tap your buddy on the shoulder and say, did you listen to the new Demon Hunter? Go check it out.
Awesome. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right, thank you.